Books Network. This is New Books in Latin American Studies. I'm your host, Christy Thornton. Today, we're joined by Susanna Rice to discuss her book, We Sell Drugs, The Alchemy of U.S. Empire, published in 2014 by the University of California Press. We Sell Drugs tells the fascinating history of how international drug control initiatives provided both material and ideological foundations for 20th century U.S. empire. The book is grounded in the transnational geography and political economy of the coca leaf and coca-derived commodities market, stretching from Peru and Bolivia into the United States and back again. Susanna Rice is Associate Professor of History at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, and I'm thrilled to have the chance to talk to her about this really important and timely book. Susanna Rice, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you for inviting me to participate.
So first, I wonder how you came to the topic of U.S. drug control. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how this project developed from a doctoral dissertation at NYU into the book we're here to discuss today, We Sell Drugs, The Alchemy of U.S. Empire?
Yes, of course. I guess it was, as probably most people's work, it was a roundabout journey that was both probably personal and professional and began before I got to grad school. I grew up moving between Canada, England, and the United States. And so I was always very much aware of American power as something looming and that I was interested in finding out more about. When I moved to the US, it was in the 1980s and I was a child and I was dropped down right in the midst of the kind of accelerated war on drugs that Reagan and his wife pursued during his administration. And watching that, I think, was a sobering experience as a child in terms of being exposed to all of the propaganda, just say no to drugs, but at the same time, seeing how so many people, as in New York City, were being picked up and thrown into the prison industrial system, essentially, at the same time as the pharmaceutical industry was all over the airwaves, beginning, particularly by the 90s, actually, to advertise every kind of drug as a, you know, quick solution to whatever ailment, imaginary or real, that people had. And I felt like that contradiction was profound. And at the same time, you're watching the news and seeing what's happening. It was sort of a moment, I guess, where I was coming into my own political consciousness, seeing what was happening in terms of the way that the drug war was facilitating U.S. military and, often illegal and covert interventions in Latin America, and just trying to piece together how you could have an industry that was so powerful and prominent and profitable and celebrated, and yet have it also form the foundations for the justification of criminalizing and policing certain populations, certain political opponents, poor and minorities in the United States. And so I think that drove me to want to understand this connection between capitalism and state coercion, and particularly around the drug war. And then I had the fortune of doing my degree at New York University with an amazing group of scholars. I originally actually started working on the African diaspora and U.S. history, really being interested in histories of racism and how they were tied to slavery and capitalism. But as I began to think about the project further and met scholars like Ada Ferrer, who I know you've worked with, and Sinclair Thompson, both Latin Americanist at NYU, and I started to look at the origins of the history of drug control, I realized that they didn't start, as many people believed, in the 1960s or 1970s with Nixon's famously proclaimed war on drugs, but actually had much deeper roots. And as I argue in the book, I think this is right, had particular roots in the emergence of the United States during and after World War II as a global power that had a newfound ability to assert its vision for international regulation of the drug trade, and was able to accomplish it. And I realized increasingly that the model that was being pursued was one that was in profound ways founded in Latin America, and that U.S. policies in Latin America became guides or sort of test runs for the way in which the United States would seek to extend its vision of drug control that it had so successfully pursued in that region on an international scale over the next half century.
Right. So I think one of the vital contributions of this book is not only this pushing our understandings of the war on drugs further back in history, as you've been saying, but the way it places it in the political economic context of U.S. empire. So I wonder if you can, before we really get into some of your own arguments, if you can elaborate on the conventional understanding of the origins of the war on drugs and how your research has challenged that understanding.
Well, I should say, I think that there's been a whole wave of scholarship recently, in particular, perhaps over the last decade and a half, that has been upending some of those more traditional understandings. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't want to say that I'm the only one doing this. I perhaps put it in a slightly different international context than many who are critical of U.S. drug policy. Mm-hmm. But I think that the traditional narrative is that the 1960s led to an explosion of recreational drug use, which in turn contributed to a massive wave of crime and urban rebellion and discontent, and that there needed to be a crackdown, or at least that was the kind of coded racial language that Nixon was able to capitalize on in identifying the war on drugs and crime as prime pillars of what his administration was going to tackle, which were really, I think, code words for an attack on the advances of the civil rights movement and the Black community in particular, but one that had a moral resonance, I think, for many people within the United States who were conflicted about what seemed to be an increasing level of recreational drug use that was quite controversial to earlier generation sensibilities, I think. And so people usually identify Nixon as having launched the war on drugs within that context of the 1970s. By the 1980s, it gets amplified by Ronald Reagan's war on drug initiative, which was tied again to, I think, domestic politics in ways in which he was so able to stigmatize, in particular, visions of, for instance, Black welfare mothers, crack queens. There are all these terribly derogatory visions of particularly African-American women and the idea that they were leeching off the state and were actually only doing so in order to get high. Mm-hmm. Even while there was an explosion in the drug that I focus on quite extensively, cocaine use among white collar Wall Street workers, that wasn't what was getting all of the public attention. So there's a sort of narrative that it was a response to social collapse, bad behavior, increase in criminality, and all of those things, I think, contributed to it was embraced by Republicans and Democrats. It contributed to a kind of political environment where being tough on crime and drug crime as being the predominant vision of what was driving crime was a very powerful tool for securing your credentials as someone who could be a good leader and mm-hmm. someone who would take care of the community. I think that some of what the work that I do does is try to shift that perspective and argue that it's not that drug control, if you actually look at its structural and historical foundations, has never actually been about protecting the public from one another or even about questions of public health, but rather has always been about establishing a system of trade around the circulation of drugs that would work to the advantage of certain vested interests, in my argument, the U.S. government and the pharmaceutical industry, and that the moral and social discussions around drug use and who are good and bad based on their consumption of drugs was more of a kind of distraction from the actual foundations. And perhaps some people who engaged in that rhetoric actually believed it, but I think that they may not have even realized the kind of structural roots that were creating those circumstances in which wielding drugs as a weapon to discredit certain members of the population had become a kind of par for the course, normal, natural, understood aspect of our cultural conversation.
It's a really interesting argument, and I want to get into it in more detail. But first, I want to ask you, the focus of the book is on the circulation and regulation of products deriving from the coca leaf, what you call coca commodities. So I wanted to ask, what's special about coca and about cocaine as opposed to other drugs that have been the target of U.S. regulations, such as marijuana or opium? Why the focus on coca here?
A couple of reasons I focus on coca. One is that coca and opium, or opiates, and things derived from opium as things derived from coca were the two primary categories that were of drugs that were first identified by the U.S. government as narcotics subject to federal control. And that happened in 1914. So marijuana didn't come under that regulatory gaze until the 1930s. Mm. So opium and coca were foundational to the history of the system that became established, and they would still occupy places of preeminence in the post-World War II era as the kind of benchmark for other drugs that may or may not be subject to regulation. Do they form addiction in the ways that scientists understood coca and coca derivatives or opium and opium derivatives to do so? So they became sort of the, I don't know, the first two drugs to really be subject to both U.S. national and then international regulation. The second reason I focus on coca as opposed to opium, though, is that opium has a much longer history of also being caught up in other imperial systems of control and regulation, particularly the British, and the geography where opium is grown in the Middle East, Australia, Afghanistan, is a very different geography from that of the coca leaf. And the coca leaf is exclusively grown, although there have been moments historically where there were efforts at cultivating it elsewhere, but essentially, and after World War II, completely, it was exclusively grown in South America in the Andes. And as such, because of the long history of U.S. Intervention, involvement, concern, efforts to control the Western Hemisphere, coca offers a kind of unique perspective on how commodities that come into being within a U.S. sphere of influence are then subject to the regulatory imperatives that the United States is trying to promote. So I felt like it gave a particular perspective on U.S. power, on U.S. post-war power, where the history of U.S. Influence and hegemony in Latin America was, in essence, as people like Greg Grandin have argued, being projected out onto a wider world. Mm-hmm. That was true too of things like the regulatory regime that the U.S. sought to implement to control coca and its derivatives in South America. Became that logic was ultimately integrated in the two decades after World War II into the international drug control regime. So the U.S. system of control, which focused on supply side control of coca production, was integrated into the international drug control regime overseen by the United Nations. And so I think coca is both a particular commodity within the U.S. sphere of influence, a commodity that shows how experiences in Latin America were drawn upon to project U.S. power in other parts of the world, and also how the United States had such a foundational influence on establishing the international regulatory tenets that would guide drug control for commodities up aside from coca, because the logic, once it was institutionalized in international treaties, became the one that guided the systems for determining which other drugs would fall under that regulatory regime. Mm-hmm.
I think that's a really important point. I want to mention the book begins in World War II, right? And so, the efforts of the Board of Economic Warfare regulating the various commodities that are important to the war effort are kind of central here, including various types of pharmaceutical drugs. So I want to ask you, what was the importance of drugs to the war mobilization, and how did U.S. regulations during wartime affect the pharmaceutical industry?
Oh, great question. I mean, one thing I should say is that it's one of the kind of, well, for me, joy of doing this kind of research is that I, when I began, didn't know I would be going back to World War II, but I was in the National Archive talking with an archivist, and I didn't even know, honestly, that the Bureau of Economic Warfare had existed. Mm-hmm. And so when he was telling me about this, I just sort of got curious and was thinking, well, how does something like coca figure into this story? And in some ways, coca as a drug during World War II wasn't as significant as in and of itself, it was more significant as being part of an entire cornucopia of medical supplies that governments during the war deemed increasingly critical to maintaining the war effort, having a healthy population that could, in the case of Bolivia and Peru, where I'm focusing on, work actively in the mines, which were producing critical raw materials to feed the U.S. war machine, essentially. So there was some sort of very practical ways in which drugs were essential to World War II. From the U.S. government perspective, massive amounts of money were devoted to subsidizing and facilitating the expansion of American pharmaceutical production of drugs like anti-malarials and penicillin, both of which were new in terms of being able to be produced on a mass scale, but were also critical for soldiers who during World War II were traveling to tropical regions where they would be likely to catch something like malaria. Mm-hmm. And so the importance of producing drugs to maintain a healthy workforce, a healthy army, was really critical. Of course, drugs like penicillin also are going to ensure that soldiers who get wounded are going to be able to overcome the infections. And there was all sorts of research. I mean, the pharmaceutical industry really exploded during World War II in terms of the array of drugs that were being produced and the scale and scope of that production. And there was a real sense of limitless possibilities. And coca, interestingly, gets pulled into that because it's long been recognized in the Andes for millennia, but even since 19th century Europeans and Americans went down there searching for new substances to experiment with in their laboratories as a stimulant. And so as a stimulant and as a painkiller, there were all sorts of experiments being done on soldiers or on Air Force pilots. Would it help them fly longer in terms of combat? Would it heal, you know, sprains faster? Will they be able to get back into action quicker if they take these drugs? And so there was a lot of experimentation happening as well. In terms of the impact on the pharmaceutical industry, one thing that's interesting is that Germany and Japan had been the primary pharmaceutical economic competitors with American businesses in South America before the war. And so Germany was actually the primary supplier of drugs to national governments, to businesses, to the general public across the region before the war. And so one thing that the United States Bureau of Economic Warfare made a priority was to try to shut down all German and Japanese business ventures in the region so as to try to undermine the flow of capital to them in an effort at weakening their capacity to wage war. Mm-hmm. Some of that was accomplished just through, you know, sea embargoes, where it was difficult to, with submarine warfare and everything else, transport goods across the Atlantic. But it was also done by trying to strong arm or promise rewards to Latin American governments if they crack down on Axis business interests. Those governments were willing to do so for the most part, but when it came to drugs and pharmaceuticals, they hit up against a real problem, which was that if they shut off those German supplies, there weren't alternative supplies. And so those governments said, look, we'll shut down all the other interests, but we're not going to shut down our medicinal stocks that are coming from German ventures unless you can provide us with alternative sources, because we think of these as being essential for public health, as being essential for showing as governments that we can, you know, effectively govern and protect our population and provide the necessities that they need to survive. So the U.S. government was in a dilemma. American companies hadn't established extensive distribution networks in the region. Bolivia and Peru, regardless, weren't huge markets for American businesses when they're looking south. There wasn't a lot of money to be made there. And so they hadn't made those regions a priority. But from a strategic standpoint during World War II, the government absolutely thought they were a priority. And so they turned to American companies and essentially called upon their patriotism, but also with a not so veiled threat of sanctions and repercussions if they didn't start to supply those alternative drugs or replacement drugs. They called it the drug replacement program. And ironically, they're turning to the very companies that had been often branches of German companies whose connection to the mother company had been broken either during World War I through German asset seizures in the United States or through World War II. So you have American Merck providing drugs that German Merck had been providing in Bolivia, or you have a number of other companies in that way. So One thing that it managed to do, though, ultimately, even though there were some, the resistance made it one of the slower initiatives of the Bureau of Economic Warfare to actually achieve its goals. But by the end of the war, U.S. companies had effectively replaced German companies as being the primary providers of medicinals in both Peru and Bolivia, which laid the foundation, I think, for their further integration into a North American economic system and sort of further dependency, where before they had had European and American markets mm-hmm. that they could play off of each other. They were now much more firmly sort of rooted into maybe a classical kind of economic dependency relationship mm-hmm. with North America.
And was this true elsewhere in Latin America, or was there something particular about the coca production relationship? Did the United States maintain these sorts of blacklists of German companies, pharmaceuticals in other Latin American countries, and force this relationship to happen elsewhere?
Yes, it did. And I confess that I know far less about other regions, but the Bureau of Economic Warfare worked across the region, and they weren't just going after pharmaceuticals. They were going after all access business interests. Mm-hmm. I was focusing on Peru and Bolivia because Peru and Bolivia were the primary places where coca leaves were being cultivated. Mm-hmm. And so by looking, it's a sort of artificial construction, but a very useful one. By looking at one particular chain of commodities, you can see how it's connected. I mean, aspirin, for instance, became a real issue mm-hmm. that they couldn't get. German Bayer supplied aspirin to the region, and they couldn't get American Bayer quickly enough to replace their aspirin supplies. And that was probably, in terms of day-to-day life, far more important than whatever was happening with coca and its mm-hmm. derivatives. But coca gave me a way of just linking an international set of places together where commodities were being transformed and exchanged between them, and then looking at how something like coca sat within a larger matrix of other pharmaceuticals and drugs and goods that were being transferred between South America and the United States. But yeah, the Bureau of Economic Warfare was definitely operative throughout the region. And my emphasis on just sort of trying to narrow the story somewhat by following the sets of countries and players attached specifically to the cultivation of coca, the production of cocaine hydrochloride, legal production of cocaine hydrochloride for medicine, or even the extraction of aspects of the leaf to produce a flavoring extract for the production of the beverage Coca-Cola. Mm-hmm. All of those things kind of locked me into a particular geography that I think has lessons for a wider world, but that was why I focused specifically on Peru and Bolivia and the United States.
Right. That's really interesting. So subsequently, you examine what happened to this nexus of pharma government control over drugs after the war. So can you tell our listeners how the drug trade was reorganized after World War II, particularly under the authority of the Treasury Department's Federal Bureau of Narcotics? And what was the result of this reorganization?
Sure. Well, one thing, because drugs had been so central to the calculus for how you wage war, there were lots of drugs circulating among the various branches of the military. And so when the war was over and it came time to demobilize, there became this huge question and concern about what's going to happen to all of these, particularly narcotics, opiates, cocaine, that were by then legally regulated, legally regulated as potentially illegal narcotic drugs. But what's going to happen when you have all these stores come back to the United States? And there was somewhat of a battle between different branches of the government and the Federal Bureau of Narcotics and its intrepid leader for 30 years, a man who in many ways is the mirror image of the FBI's Hoover, but a man named Harry J. Anslinger, the commissioner of narcotics. He was very influential in pushing his political connections. He had a lot of friends in Congress to make sure that the Federal Bureau of Narcotics became the sole authority for controlling narcotic surpluses that were being demobilized by the army, but also more generally narcotic surpluses in the United States. And this is happening though at the same time where you have the sort of legacy of the massive investment in the pharmaceutical industry during World War II only leads to its further expansion in the war's aftermath. So you have the U.S. And a desire, actually, on the part of the U.S. government, as well as industry, not just the pharmaceutical industry, but the pharmaceutical industry was one of the more successful industries at accomplishing this goal, the desire to extend what they argue were the fruits of American capitalism on a global scale, with the idea that not only would this bring profits back to the United States and stability and peace and security, but that this would be a path forward globally for a new post-war era being led by an American capitalist vision, what someone like the publisher Henry Luce termed the American century. And so I think that goal of controlling drugs was happening at the same time as the massive expansion of drug production, both for domestic consumption. You had an explosion in all sorts of new drugs on the market, all variations of amphetamines and quaaludes, things, you know, the mother's little helper. Truck drivers were taking drugs to stay awake. Teenagers were taking drugs to do well in their exams. There was just this massive explosion. But also the United States was largely, again, because of its defeat of the primary pharmaceutical competitors, Germany and Japan, during the war, the United States emerges as the global supplier of pharmaceuticals and medicines. And so the need to control those drugs is amplified even while the production and circulation of those drugs is growing and growing and growing. And so this creates an interesting dynamic of trying to make sure that drugs are going into legitimate, or what people like Anslinger deem legitimate, markets, even while there's increasing anxiety over the possibilities of their illegal diversion into the black market. Mm-hmm.
I want to get into this distinction between legitimate and illegitimate uses. As the Cold War gets underway, of course, international efforts at drug control, including under the UN Commission on Narcotic Drugs, began to target these coca-producing regions in the Andes, as you mentioned, particularly in Peru and Bolivia. So how did the Commission on Narcotic Drugs come to define the border between legitimate and illegitimate uses of coca? And what was the result in the communities where this coca had actually traditionally been grown?
Yeah. Well, coca, and this is perhaps going back to your earlier question, sort of why focus on coca specifically. One thing that's interesting is that the United Nations obviously is a creation of the peace of World War II. One of the first bodies that the United Nations create is under its authority, or under its, I guess, umbrella, is the Commission on Narcotic Drugs. The Commission on Narcotic Drugs was profoundly influenced by the United States, in part because Harry Anslinger, the Federal Bureau of Narcotics Commissioner, is appointed as the U.S. representative to that body at the United Nations, and he exerts an inordinate amount of influence over what is going to be the agenda that they're going to pursue. And the first thing that they pursue, and this is at the instigation of Anslinger, and in part at the instigation of Anslinger's friends in the pharmaceutical industry in the United States, is an effort to control the circulation of coca leaves. And so he and the commission essentially argue that the most urgent aspect of post-war drug control is the need to pursue regulating the production of drug raw materials at their source, what some people say supply-side drug control, which essentially means trying to limit the cultivation, in this case, of coca leaves in Peru and Bolivia to supplies that the U.S. and through the Commission on Narcotic Drugs, the United Nations deem as legitimate. And what comes to define that legitimacy in their terms is that coca leaves should only be cultivated if they are destined for medical, what they call medical and scientific uses. Mm. Ironically, because of the role that Coca-Cola had played within the coca industry, the U.S. and Anslinger are able to get an exemption for them, that there's medical and scientific uses and for use as a non-narcotic flavoring extract, which is an exclusive aspect of those international treaty negotiations that was written explicitly for the Coca-Cola company. So that's the logic that gets enshrined, and it's partly enshrined through what is ostensibly an exploratory mission organized by the United Nations. It's actually led by a former pharmaceutical, U.S. pharmaceutical executive who leads these commissioners to Peru and Bolivia to study what they call the coca problem. And the coca problem is one that they suggest to the Peruvian and Bolivian governments is one that, needs more research. But in fact, as the archives and their correspondence shows, essentially what they were doing is they were traveling down there to try to convince local governments to go along with their vision of supply side control. And one aspect of that supply side control for the Bolivian and Peruvian governments that was particularly egregious was that the U.S., because of its own regulatory history and desire to maintain itself as the primary manufacturer of medicines and other things, refused to import any coca leaves in their raw material. Refused to import coca leaves in anything other than their raw material state. Mm-hmm. So you could only export from Peru and Bolivia raw coca leaves that would arrive in pharmaceutical laboratories in New Jersey and be transformed into cocaine hydrochloride and transformed into a Coca-Cola flavoring extract. But from the Peruvian and Bolivian perspective, particularly from the political elite and from scientists who are doing research on this issue and from entrepreneurs who are hoping to capitalize on the possibilities for transforming coca into a variety of commodities that could be sold nationally or even on the world market, for them, it was really frustrating because they were being shut out of essentially any manufacturing process, and they were being limited to producing raw materials exclusively for that international market, which significantly weakened their position vis-a-vis international trade, but also in terms of their own possibilities of capitalizing on the commodity potential of that drug. That's the political and economic elite. When the UN commissioners are traveling down there, they witness and view and study many in the population in Bolivia, for instance, is majority Aymara and Quechua. So the majority of people living in those countries are indigenous peoples, and yet they're not spoken to as serious stakeholders in this marketplace, even though they had been the prime consumers and marketers and people involved in the cultivation and trade of the coca leaf for centuries. They're not spoken of as people whose opinions on this new regulatory vision, whose opinion should be taken seriously. Rather, their approach is objects of study. What is the impact of the coca leaf on the indigenous body? And these kinds of very problematic objectification of indigenous peoples provided the foundation for a conversation among scientists and the political elite that ultimately stigmatizes indigenous consumption of coca leaf as a form of addiction that's holding back national development and harming indigenous people. And those kinds of arguments were very destructive in terms of, delegitimizing cultural practices that had been around for millennia, but also in terms of marginalizing or at least reflecting the general political and economic marginalization of those communities within their respective countries. Mm-hmm. So the attack on or the effort at and actually the treaties that ultimately are agreed upon based in part on the research that this commission did in the Andes after World War II, have written into them a clause that says all indigenous coca consumption in its raw material state. Again, the raw material is only legitimate according to international drug control if it's going to be transformed into medically and scientifically valuable commodities. Mm-hmm. From their perspective, raw coca leaves and the way they're traditionally consumed in mates or chewed, or even used in rituals and other practices in the Andes or as monetary exchange, as a form of cash, all of that was deemed illegitimate and was destined to be eliminated within 20 years of any country signing on to the international agreement. So that gave those national states a lot of power to crack down on indigenous social mobilizations, simply not by addressing their political or economic demands, but by going after cultural practices and criminalizing behaviors that had been part and parcel of, you know, daily social existence for a very long time. Mm-hmm. So there is a real immediate negative impact that you could see going right up, I mean, to the late 20th century, where you would have American Drug Enforcement Agency helicopters working with local governments to eradicate coca crops with pesticides that are poisoning the environment, destroying people's livelihoods, even while they're protecting massive coca plantations that are growing coca leaves for North American pharmaceutical and the Coca-Cola company.
Right. It's a fascinating story. And if not exactly parallel, there's another interesting story that you tell in the book at this moment in which the United States comes to seek to develop so-called wonder drugs. And in particular, you mentioned this fascinating case of a so-called narcotics farm run by the U.S. Public Health Service in Lexington, Kentucky. So can you tell our listeners what the objectives of this narcotics farm were and what sort of research was carried out there?
Yes. First, I just want to say quickly, too, though, that I think I also want to make a point, though, that even though Aymara and Quechua consumers of coca were targeted, they never stopped practicing their traditions, and which has led to a long ongoing struggle, including most recently the president of Bolivia refusing to go along with the dictates of international drug control so far as they identify coca as a drug. So there was resistance to this throughout, and a resistance that in some ways has been successful. So I just wanted to say that it wasn't all an imposition. There was pushback, and pushback that ultimately triumphed, at least in terms of people being able to access coca and continue to consume it in whatever ways they want to in that region. But the narcotics farm is a crazy thing. And this actually sort of also ties into these stigmatizing conversations. Mm-hmm. One of the ways in which, or the way in which it was determined by national and international regulators, whether or not a new drug should fall under the treaties governing drug control, was whether or not that drug was deemed addictive. And addiction is a notoriously difficult thing to pin down. Ironically, when cocaine first fell under international or national regulation, it's not considered addictive in the medical sense of that term. Opiates are considered addictive, and the medical or the scientific definition of addiction has to do with whether or not a drug causes physiological withdrawal. Mm-hmm. But regardless of that scientific designation, in terms of law, if it's called a narcotic, it's deemed addictive. And coca, as I mentioned earlier, was one of two drugs, opium being the other, that were identified as narcotics subject to control. So legally, it's an addictive drug. But what addiction is very nebulous. Mm-hmm. And so I think what the narcotics farm was, it was a prison/research center run by the U.S. Public Health Service in Lexington. And essentially, it was a prison that was designed to house people who had committed a crime and were also deemed to be addicted to a narcotic drug. This is, again, it's at a moment where you're starting to have a new, much more aggressive national system of policing drug consumption. So the prison industrial complex or the explosion of prisons or of people being in prison for drug consumption that happened particularly in the 80s, there was an earlier moment where that began in the 1950s, mm-hmm. where you had the first national drug laws that were quite severe, had mandatory minimum sentences. Selling drugs near minors could result even in the death penalty. It was a very, very aggressive system. So you're starting to have more people being caught up in the net of policing because of their drug use. And then you have this new or this institution where drug users ostensibly would benefit from being separated from the general criminal population. Within the narcotics farm, they had a addiction research center, which was explicitly designed to try out new concoctions being churned out by the pharmaceutical industry to see essentially if they could, you know, hit the holy grail of pain medication, which would be to be able to provide a drug that isn't addictive and that still accomplishes the pain relief that opiates provide. So there were all sorts of new formulas that the pharmaceutical industry was testing, and you had what they viewed as, and this is all before subject review boards or that came into existence in the 1970s that were concerned with the ethical dimensions of testing people without their consent or awareness about what it was that they were being tested for. So this is all in an earlier era. And these prisoner patients were deemed kind of ideal guinea pigs for these drugs because ethically they argued, well, they're already addicts, so we're not going to addict them more. And we can also test on experienced subjects the variations in the experience of withdrawal in what addiction looks like with these new various concoctions. It's pretty scandalous, I think. I mean, what they were doing there. And those, the definition of addiction is also being redefined and redefined through these kinds of scientific experiments that are happening at institutions like the Lexington Narcotics Farm. And the Narcotics Farm actually was the major source of research information that would be shared with bodies like the World Health Organization that advised the UN Commission on Narcotic Drugs to determine the status of whether a drug was addictive and then hence should be put under regulatory control. So the Narcotic Farm was a national agency that did a lot of work that helped the pharmaceutical industry, but it also was one that helped feed scientific data into international systems or international organizations that were trying to devise lists of drugs that should be subject to control. There's a kind of interesting counterpoint to that addiction story in the Andes, where you had that gaze that I was talking about that objectified indigenous people did so often by arguing that they were obviously addicted to these drugs because they were consuming cocaine. Ironically, they were consuming coca, so the amount of cocaine they were getting from their leaves is well, I guess you could argue over whether or not addiction is an appropriate term or whether or not addiction to it would be a bad thing to begin with. But they devised a new definition of addiction having to do with not the physiological properties of the drug, but as they tried to pin down what makes something addictive or not addictive, they came up with a very expansive definition that it wasn't necessarily what the drug did to the individual indigenous consumer, but rather what that drug posed as a threat to the larger social body. So if you had people consuming coca on breaks and their landlords or supervisors saying, well, you're being lazy, then that's no longer, the addiction is no longer a threat just to their own, you know, possibility of earning a wage, but it becomes a threat to the entire integrity of the system and of the company and of the operation or of the, you know, agricultural output. And so you started to have these very, very broad notions of addiction that addicts posed a threat not just to themselves, but to everyone else, which also facilitated the idea that you could lock them up and use them as guinea pigs for the greater social good because they posed a threat to the social good. So they needed to be re-engineered as productive members of society. And if they couldn't reintegrate into society, why not have them, you know, use their bodies, or why not use their bodies for scientific research that could benefit others, which is a really dark and disturbing, I think, aspect of this whole story. Funnily, the Narcotic Farm has a huge, in the book, there's a picture of it over the doorway. It had this huge engraved title, Narcotic Farm, which caused a lot of public confusion because people wondered if they were actually growing narcotics there. And in fact, what the farm aspect of it was that they were trying, they, along with some of this research that they were doing, they also had work regimens and daily activities that were ostensibly designed to try to help people be rehabilitated and acquire the skills to be reintegrated as productive members of society. But arguably, I think they were producing narcotics there in the sense that they were testing out new formulas and trying to devise compositions or substances that the industry and potentially, I guess, the population could benefit from or profit from.
It's a really fascinating story. And again, the parallels just keep popping up because you also discuss in the book, you have a chapter on the ways in which the United States tried to cultivate what you call capitalist consumer habits in the Andes, the region where coca was produced, through technical assistance programs run by agencies like USAID and its predecessors and other affiliated agencies. So how did these programs seek to inculcate what U.S. planners saw as the correct and modern kinds of consumption habits abroad?
Yeah, well, coca definitely didn't figure into modern consumer habits that were being celebrated and extolled. So some of the sort of social engineering that I see as having happened at the narcotic farm in Lexington was echoed in similar kinds of expansive visions of how you reorganize communities in the Andes, particularly communities. I focus on this one community in that part of the book called Vicos in Peru, where you had a hacienda that Cornell University anthropologists lease from the hacienda owner. But in that time period, the hacienda owner actually also owned the workers who lived on the hacienda. So Cornell goes down there, and when they acquire this lease, they're acquiring the lease not just because they're interested in testing out new agricultural technological innovations like pesticides and other things, which they see, and they weren't the only ones. I mean, during the 50s and 60s, the sense of possibility for the kind of green revolution was tangible for many. So they're going down there trying to modernize what they see as a pre-modern community, mm-hmm. Introduce new agricultural techniques. But at the same time, they wanted to guide the population, the indigenous population that had lived and worked on the hacienda as, again, essentially peasant farmers owned by the hacienda owner, into productive modern workers, wage workers in particular. So they're trying to change something. And I hesitate to use feudal system, but I feel like that might be an analogy that captures at least some of the dynamics that they were perceiving as existing on this hacienda, where the workers had to work a certain number of hours on behalf of the owner of the hacienda without pay, just to secure access to their own little plots of land. They were trying to transform this system into one that reflected what they saw as the necessary path towards modernization, which involved introducing large-scale agriculture being produced particularly for export, but also workers being paid for wages. The Cornell anthropologists actually, when they assumed the lease, didn't immediately free the population. They kept them in their state of indenture for another, I can't remember now if it's 5 or 6 years, but during that time period, they tried to teach them what they thought were, you know, modern work habits and social habits and ways of being, which meant trying to eradicate traditional practices like coca consumption, but also encouraging them to do, well, many things that actually contradicted particularly the traditional gender roles that existed within those communities, where they're suddenly introducing women, saying women who had often in the Andes been the prime players in bringing goods to market, in participating in the economic life, essentially, not only of the community, but of the family. They're trying to introduce them to things like sewing, and they're trying to get the men. I mean, they're just rearranging the sort of jobs and tasks that they see the traditional ways of being as being in need of transformation. And so I think part of that too is introducing them to modern medicines, as opposed to going to traditional healing practices. You should go to a clinic and get your drugs. And those drugs, of course, are going to be manufactured in the United States. And right, so I guess right. I tie the knot a little tightly there because there's other things going on, but I do see all of these, this kind of effort at revolutionizing social practices and consumer practices and the attack on tradition as being part and parcel of what was necessary to promote the integration of areas like Vicos into an international economic system that is centered around the consumption of goods being manufactured in the United States.
Wow. So toward the end of the book, you look at the ways in which narcotics come to be paired with communism, racial tension, violence, and political rebellion, both at home and abroad. That is, the ways in which drug trafficking and use come to be seen as existential threats to the United States and its way of life in this Cold War context. So can you maybe explain how this connection was drawn and the resultant system of policing that it engendered?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think one thing that's sort of interesting is that from World War II through the 1950s, you have this process of first sort of defining the realm of drug control, what rules are going to govern it, who can participate legally and who can't participate legally within the cultivation, distribution, production, consumption of drugs. And by the time you get to, well, the late 50s and 60s, and the Cold War is really heating up, and it starts a little bit earlier, actually, it's sort of, they happen in tandem. But along with the kind of consolidation of a regulatory system, and embedded within that, the capacity for the expansion of pharmaceutical drug production and distribution, you also have a growing ideological or symbolic power attached to the stigma of being accused of illegally participating within that marketplace. So you begin to have a very powerful tool that can be wielded to go after political opponents or racial and ethnic minorities or people challenging the class hierarchies that exist, that instead of recognizing social and political struggles, which were growing in Latin America, in the United States, the early civil rights movement around the world, post-colonial or not post-colonial, but national liberation movements after World War II, you have a very powerful tool for shifting the dynamics away from a political analysis or an economic analysis into one that focuses on individual behaviors and the criminalization of individual behaviors. And you see over and over again, even in 1949 in Peru, there was a military coup that brought General Odría into office. And one of the first things that he does, and I think he did this in part to essentially show his allegiance or willingness to work with the United States, was to go after his political opponents by implementing the first set of national drug control laws. And he essentially uses drug control as a way of accusing political opposition of being criminals and trying to throw them in jail rather than have a debate about their political platforms or the nature of the social critique they were leveling. And this happens over and over. And I think in the United States, you see it very, I argue that the 1950s, part of the reason for the aggressive legislative assault on so-called drug crimes that happened. There were two different major national pieces of legislation, drug control acts that dictated harsh penalties, was a very explicit response to the emergence of Black demands for civil rights, equality, and cultural respect. And it became a very easy way of targeting the Black community. And people have made this argument in the late 60s as well as a more explicit response to the successes of the civil rights movement. But I think it began earlier. I think it began in the 1950s, that this is a way of extending the justification for policing of certain communities, largely through a specter that emerged in the 1950s of the threat that Black drug consumption, jazz, posed to white teenagers who might be corrupted and fall into lives of delinquency. And that kind of national utility of drugs as a convenient foil, in a sense, for masking social and political and economic conflict was also true internationally, where you had many of the national liberation struggles around the world, whether it be in Kenya or even in Vietnam or in China, or revolutions, whether we want to refer to them as national liberation struggle, I guess we can debate. But many of these kind of political upheavals that the United States is concerned about, particularly in the early years of growing Cold War anxiety and new ways of defining national security that had to do with the Cold War, it becomes very easy to stigmatize all those movements as being driven by these deeper, nefarious, psychological, physiological, drug-induced madness or something. And so you have the Mau Mau in Kenya, you have the Chinese communists, you have all of these, the Fidel Castro, once the revolution happens in Cuba, all of them being very rapidly accused of being involved in drug trafficking as a way of attempting to discredit the legitimacy of their new government. Ironically, most of the communist regimes, China, Cuba, were actually some of the harshest governments to crack down internally on illegal drug consumption. So it's actually a massive distortion. But from the perspective of someone like Harry Anslinger, if he could talk about the communist dope menace and argue that communists were trying to infiltrate the United States by undermining the will of the population by hooking them on drugs, it just further sort of strengthened, at least in his mind, and in some material ways, it actually really did strengthen his position of bargaining before Congress, but also of presenting the United States position before the United Nations Commission on Narcotic Drugs and elsewhere, where those kinds of accusations carried very real political ramifications. And so it just became part of an arsenal, I think, of a kind of symbolic way of very quickly tapping into people's moral and ethical sense of righteousness, mm-hmm. as opposed to any more studied critique of the structures and political, economic, and social origins of the conflicts that were happening in the world at that time. Mm-hmm.
So we just have a few minutes left, but finally, I wonder if you can reflect on how this history might be informing, whether knowingly or not, current debates about drug control regimes. As you mentioned earlier, of course, over the last decade or so, Bolivia's president, Evo Morales, has rejected the international system of drug control that came to dominate his country's cultivation of coca over the preceding decades. And here in the United States, we're in a moment in which there seems to be a nascent conversation, recognizing that the war on drugs that grew from the systems you trace in your book has been indeed a spectacular failure. So are there lessons to be taken from the period you cover here to inform the current debate, both domestically and internationally?
I hope so. I mean, I think, as you're saying, I think this moment is very promising and also worrying in different ways. It's promising because there has been, I think, a seismic shift in especially prominent political public figures' willingness to challenge the tenets of drug control and the way that drug control has been institutionalized over the last half century. And so Evo Morales has done that, but so have former presidents of Colombia and Mexico, Kofi Annan, the former Director General of the United Nations. All of these people have come out and actually formed organizations to study the question of decriminalization and have made public calls for decriminalizing drugs because they argue that it's indisputable that the drug war has been a failure, at least on its own terms, at least if the goal of the drug war ever was to eliminate illegal drug consumption, it has had the opposite impact. Right. I don't think that was ever its goal. I think that its goal was much more about consolidating certain kinds of economic and political power. But so I think that, and in the United States, the move to legalize and decriminalize marijuana, I think is only going to open up conversations about other drugs, even though I think if you say something like cocaine in the same breath as marijuana, people are sort of like, oh, you know, hard drug, soft drug. But I think it's all of this interest in criminalizing any drug, marijuana in this case, can only further the desire to experiment with alternative systems of regulation that might not lead to such disproportionate attacks on poor people and communities of color in terms of who suffers the brunt of incarceration or even lack of access to necessary medicines for that matter. Which gets me to the part that I think is a little scary about our contemporary world, which is that I don't know. I mean, it's very mysterious, the details of the negotiations that are happening, for instance, with the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement that's being negotiated right now by the White House and a number of powers around the Pacific Rim, where it seems like from the little bits of information that trickle out, embedded within that agreement are massive handouts to the European and American pharmaceutical industries in terms of them being able to hold on to patents for longer periods of time, in terms of them being able to crack down on generic competitors in third world markets. And I fear that if those provisions are what they seem to be, at least from the rumors that are circulating, that the few advances that have been made by countries like Brazil and India in trying to develop generic pharmaceutical industries to be able to supply their populations with much needed drugs at affordable prices could face serious scrutiny and even disillusion if the pharmaceutical industry's, you know, profit-driven model of patent protections is able to extend itself into regions that had previously tried to push back against that based on their own sense of the need for alternative systems of medicinal production and distribution just because of the economic circumstances that their population finds themselves in. So I think there's a lot of hopeful things going on, but there's also a lot of ways in which until the conversations about illegal drugs and drug control are wedded to a serious conversation where there's more transparency about legal production of pharmaceuticals, that will be the whole picture won't be being dealt with at once, which I think could lead to all sorts of distortions and unpredictable outcomes. So I guess if one thing could come out of this book, I would hope that perhaps the legal and the illegal markets could be discussed as part of one seamless whole rather than as two separate beasts that need to be regulated and understood differently.
Well, Susanna Rice, thank you so much for this really fascinating and timely book and for taking the time to discuss it with us today.
Christy, thank you so much for having me.
That's Susanna Rice, Associate Professor in the Department of History at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. And we've been discussing her book, We Sell Drugs, The Alchemy of U.S. Empire, out in 2014 from the University of California Press.